I'm Charlie Wilmoth.
I'm David Todd.
And welcome to the Bucks Dugout Podcast. What's up, everybody? We are back for the fifth episode of the Bucks Dugout Podcast. Later on in the podcast, we're going to be talking to Eric Steven from the Dodgers blog True Blue LA about the Pirates' upcoming series against the Dodgers. But first, we'd like to talk a little bit about the series that just passed against the Phillies. David, you had a really good post earlier on Monday about the Pirates and the differences between the Pirates and the Phillies managing over the series and what a difference that made. Earlier today, you pointed out that the Phillies are playing them. They just finished a game against the Marlins today in which they lost 6-2. And it turns out that the Phillies closer, Jonathan Papelbon, pitched a game of a mop-up inning of that game because he didn't get into the series, the last two games of the series against the Pirates. This seems like the way they're using him is straight out of the Pirates 2011 season and their usage of Joel Hanrahan.
A little bit out of the Clint Hurdle handbook from last year. A really good weekend series for the Pirates overall. Yeah, you got to step back and say you're facing Holiday, Lee, and Worley. If you can get two out of three, you'd be ecstatic, particularly after watching game one where the offense, it's a combination of facing one of the best pitchers in the game. You get two leadoff hits and you don't get another hit for the next 27 outs. So a little bit concerned. You go through five innings of the next game, you haven't scored a run. They finally get a run across the plate on a wild pitch of all things, which if Cliff Lee had covered the plate right and, paid a little bit more attention, I think Yumiko Navarro was definitely going to be out there. So Pirates got a little bit of a break, and they go on and win the game. And as you said, Charlie Manuel doesn't at any point there use Jonathan Papelbon, the guy who I referred to in the article on Bucks Dugout as the $50 million man. I mean, you paid this guy, you're paying him $11 million this year, $13 the next 3 years. He's going to make $50 million. He has been one of the best closers in Major League Baseball since 2006. He's got to be your go-to guy. And, of course, in game one of that series on Thursday, he did come in and pitch the ninth inning, threw 10 pitches, three batters, one strikeout, and it's in the books. The Phils win 1-0, and he looked good doing it. So we didn't see him because of this, I'm going to say it's because of the saved statistic. We see that managers on the road in close games or extra inning games are unwilling to go to a guy who has been anointed the closer because they want to wait and use him in a saved situation. Conversely, we saw Clint Hurdle say there is no save. I think it's because there is no save. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm going to put my best pitcher out there in the ninth inning and get three outs. Well, Joel Hanrahan did just that. The Pirates didn't score. Hurdle had to go to somebody else. Juan Cruz did a nice job, and the Pirates score and win the game. And then, lo and behold, we go see this same kind of events unfold on Sunday in the 4-3, 5-4 win in the bottom of the ninth, but where Philadelphia's up 4-3. They've got Bastardo on the mound, and he's a very good reliever. But it's 4-3, and you've got the Pirates making some batting changes. And it's an ideal situation if you're going to go to a four-out save to call Papelbon in. You had Pedro Alvarez coming to bat. Clint Hurdle makes I think a very debatable decision. I was for it, but I could understand why some people might not be for it. He pinch hits Haig for Alvarez. And, of course, if you're going to be a results-based analyst, you're absolutely for it because Haig gets his first major league hit, ties the game. The Pirates go to Hanrahan again in the ninth. The Phillies don't score, and the Pirates get the run in the bottom of the ninth against this kid that nobody's ever heard of, who's been on their roster for 2 years, but is really just kind of a no-name middle reliever. So, Charlie Manuel, two games, didn't use his guy. They lose both games, and then here we are. They're in their home opener, and they're down 5-2 in the ninth inning, and they've got to bring in Jonathan Papelbon to get some work. He gives up a home run. They lose 6-2. Because they're off tomorrow, and he would have gone 4 days without pitching, Charlie. And it's a pet peeve. I'm not the first guy to point this stuff out. People have been pointing it out for years now. But these roles that people get kind of encapsulated into oftentimes are to the detriment of the team. And I give Clint Hurdle great credit, as I did in the article, for all the moves he pulled this weekend. The sacrifice bunts worked. The pinch runners worked. I mean, just everything he did turned to gold, and it worked out beautifully for the Pirates. But I looked back at the games, the four games last year the Pirates played in extra innings. that that weren't the result of a blown save by Hanrahan. They lost all four games, and Hanrahan didn't pitch. And most famously or infamously is the 19-inning game in Atlanta. And that was followed up shockingly by another extra-inning game that went 10 where Hanrahan didn't pitch. So, you retitled the article for me, and I think you did it just right in saying, you know, you managed the pants off Charlie Manuel over the weekend, but your history shows you would have done the same thing. Mm-hmm. And obviously the point of the article is to suggest maybe seeing it up close and personal and seeing it so early in the season, maybe he wouldn't do the same thing.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, the part about Bastardo, I guess, is debatable whether Bastardo should have finished that inning in the ninth. I think the pitcher spot would have come up fourth in the eighth. The pitcher spot would have come up fourth in the top of the ninth. So that's at least debatable. But the decision to put Herndon out there instead of Papelbon is just awful. What did you make of his decision of Manuel's decision to pitch to McCutchen in the first place?
You know, I have to say I was kind of 75-25 against it. You know, you have Neil Walker coming up. You have a righty there in Herndon, so Walker's going to turn around and bat lefty. That's his better side. You know, I don't know enough about Herndon's stuff, about how he reacts, but I would have probably walked him or pitched around him. And what's so interesting about that at bat is he got two early strikes on Andrew McCutchen. I mean, I think people who are killing the Phillies kind of forget the fact that the kid went 0-2 on him. And then I don't know that Andrew actually fouled anything off. I think maybe he took three straight balls. And I was thinking, you know what, that's exactly how the kid should be pitching to him. So he's doing it right by the book. He happened to get ahead, so see if he can get cuts to chase. And then he grooves a 3-2 fastball, and, you know, that's great for Pirate fans. But I got to tell you, if I'm a Phillies fan, I am throwing my hands up in the air going, what the hell just happened?
Right, right. And going back to the decision between Alvarez and Matt Haig, maybe you could talk a little bit about the dynamics of that decision, and then also what do you think that says about just the way Pedro has played so far this season in general.
Well, as we talked about, I think on Thursday, the at bats that Pedro took in the first game, I thought were actually pretty good, and it tells you a lot about how far Pedro has fallen or what people are thinking about Pedro when he has three at bats and he strikes out once, and people feel like he had a really good approach at the plate.
Really grasping at straws, it's true.
Yeah, really, really grasping at straws. We saw him strike out in his first at bat. He obviously sat Saturday against Lee, and then he struck out in his first at bat against Worley on a looked like a high changeup to me. But I didn't think it was a terrible – it wasn't a good bat. Okay, period. It wasn't a good bat. And then he hits the absolute bomb into the river when he gets, a straight change, belt high. You're not going to ask for a better pitch to hit. So, the fact is he hit it a mile. So good for him. But I do think I don't think there's any problem with pinch hitting there, because I think they've made it clear to Pedro they're going to sit him down against some of the tough lefties early in the season. I would be surprised if he gets the start tomorrow with Kershaw pitching, so I think he'll be sitting again tomorrow. And I think they've managed kind of the psychological aspect of things like that. I think if you told him he's going to play every day and you come up in that situation and then you sit him down, I think there'd be more to it. But I was good with it, and I think Clint handled it very well in the post game, saying, look, this isn't the way, you know, Pedro's not going to be pinch hit for a lot in his career if things go the way we expect him to. But we felt like, you know, we want him to have a good approach, get his feet on the ground, get his foundation built here. And we thought, you know, in terms of winning the game, that was in our best interest. And that's the best answer Clint Hurdle could give for me as a fan. And I assume that, you know, he's got the psychological aspect of things with Pedro kind of sorted out. So, I was happy with that decision. You know, I think most of the people on Bucks Dugout and a lot of people we talked to are against bunting, but I thought the decision to bunt guys over in some of these games was a pretty good decision. Unfortunately, Jose, who now sounds like he's Tabata, according to himself on the pregame introductions on Sunday, unfortunately, he didn't come through on two occasions. And I have to say, I'm not a huge Josh Harrison fan. But you know, one thing you're pretty certain is Josh Harrison is going to give you contact, and it just feels like he's more likely to hit a line drive or a fly ball right now than Jose Tabata. So I'd like to see him get off the schneid a little bit. He did get some hits, but didn't hit many balls hard. But I think overall of the first weekend, Charlie, the guys, I think I got almost exactly what I expected. Alex Presley looked good, getting his hands through the zone. Tabata not great. Clint Barmas obviously struggled at the plate. Barajas and McGahee, I think, did exactly what we expected them to do. When they hit the ball, they can hit it hard, and they can hit it a long way. McGahee, I call him McGahee because I read his name every once in a while.
I'm tempted to do that too.
So McGee, he hits the ball hard. He hit that ball off the wall and right. So, generally a good feeling on the weekend. It was really great to see Andrew McCutchen have a big game on Sunday. So, I came away feeling pretty positive. I still think this is a team that could only score 600 runs, so they're going to have to pitch well. And, boy, they got good pitching. I mean, J-Mac didn't have his best stuff. He didn't get a lot of strikeouts. He struggled in the first inning and a half, first two innings that he pitched. But as we saw so often last year, even though he'd thrown 30 pitches in two innings, he settled down and he got through six, and he could have gone out the seventh. In fact, he was coming out for the seventh.
He wanted to come out for the seventh.
He sure did. So I think, I think all things, just a positive vibe generally from the weekend. But everything I think I said in my preseason kind of rundown, I still hold to, they are going to be offensively challenged.
Right. And after the first game in which they only got, they got no hits after the first inning, the first two batters, I was really, preparing myself for a season in which, I know it's just one game. You don't want to overreact too much to one game. It's overreaction day. It's what they call it on Twitter. But it really did confirm that this is going to be a team that struggles offensively. But it was great to see them, even if they didn't put up much offense in that second game, to show the heart to win it, and then to score five runs and generally put up a bunch of offense in that third game. It was great to see, especially since most of the pitchers they're going to be facing this year are going to be more like Worley than the first two guys they face.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing your preview of the Dodgers series. They go on this 9-game West Coast trip, Charlie, and we talked about how, if they went 1-2 against Philadelphia, which obviously if you lose the first game, that feels like that's more than likely, then you can go out there, and if you have a disaster and you go 2-7, or even if you go 3-6, it certainly brings some of that early season exuberance to a quick halt. Mm-hmm. I think that's why winning that game, and if they can go out there and go on this trip, and really I'll call it a success, I'll call the trip a success at 4-5. Anything better than that is really good. I think 3-6 is fine. I'd hate to see him go. Obviously, we'd all hate to see him do worse than that. But I really think, if they can take a game or two from the Dodgers, they'll be in fantastic shape going into the other two. And then, come home and see what happens. The good thing about having a ridiculously hard April schedule is when that's done, that's done. And it should get a little bit easier the rest of the way. And, we've seen the Yankees and the Red Sox are both 0-3. I mean, we're not going to make any decisions based on three games or on 15 games. But, I'd love to see them come home from this trip around 500 and go from there. But let me turn it to you and ask you just kind of the players, your assessment overall of anybody who kind of stood out or was maybe the three-game impression was slightly different than what you expected coming into the season.
Eric Bedard, for sure, to pitch that well in the first game. We knew when he's healthy, he's a good pitcher. But, man, when you get used to so much Pirates baseball, you get used to seeing lots of pitchers who don't necessarily look like they have much of a plan. Bedard doesn't have the best stuff in the world, obviously, but that breaking ball is pretty darn good, and he really knows how to use it. And to see, it looked like the Phillies just really did not want to deal with his breaking ball, and so he was able to throw first and second pitch strikes with that breaking ball over and over and over again, and then get them in really bad spots later in the count with those fastballs, and that really worked for him over and over and over, and he honestly just looked like he knew exactly what he was doing out there. And you see that a little bit with Karstens. You saw that at times, that having a plan in that way. You saw that at times with Zach Duke, sometimes maybe you didn't. But with so many Pirates starters in the past 5 or 10 years, you don't see that kind of planning, or at least you don't see those kinds of plans that actually go well.
Yeah, yeah. And let me ask you this before we get into more of the pitchers. We think of the Phillies as a team that's won a World Series, won 102 games this past year. But clearly that lineup is impotent, to say the least. Without Ryan Howard, without Chase Utley, you've got Rollins and Polanco, and certainly Hunter Pence, I think, is a really good player. Mm-hmm. But that's not the same Philadelphia lineup that we've seen the past couple of years.
No, you maybe run the risk of people have talked about that so much in the past week or so. you know, there are still a bunch of major league players in there. It's just not, you know, like some of the Pirates lineups we've seen over the years or anything like that. It's not a great offensive team, but I don't think it's a terrible one either. And for sure, the Pirates starters deserve a ton of credit for what happened this.
Yeah,
this
that's
weekend.
Good. That's a good point. What about the rest of the staff? What impressions on guys?
Well, one thing we talked about before we went on the air is Evan Meek and how the Pirates plan to use Evan Meek this year. They had a chance to go to Meek when the game was close on Sunday, but instead they turned to Jared Hughes. Hughes gives up a couple of unearned runs, and then they bring in Meek when it looks like they're out of it. Actually, it turns out they're not out of it, but it looked like it was their game
so
to lose at that point.
It'd be an inning or two, yeah.
Yeah, what do you think about that? Are we going to see Meek mostly in a mop-up role from now on?
For sure, for now. No question to me. He is the last guy on the staff in terms of where he's going to be used. Now that, you know, obviously we're going to see two roster moves here in the next 2 weeks, so some of those things are going to change. But I'm not 100% confident that Evan Meek has a roster spot locked down going forward. What I saw yesterday was it was good to see his velocity, that he touched 93 on the gun, but I didn't see the tight late break on, you know, whatever you want to call his out pitch, his breaking ball pitch that he throws in the, you know, it's not quite Hanrahan slider, but his cutter or his slider, he throws it up there, you know, 86, 87, and sometimes 88 miles an hour as well. But what he has that we see from Hanrahan is just that really hard late break that when you're throwing a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, just makes it means you have to react that much more quickly. And I didn't see that yesterday. I didn't see great command. Look, he had a 1-2-3 inning, so that's fine. But if you want to take a scout's perspective on how he pitched, I just wasn't that impressed. I don't know that I saw anything there that wants me to hurry to get him into higher leverage situations. On the flip side of that, I'll tell you, I was really impressed with Juan Cruz in his two outings over the weekend. I think what I saw was three different pitches. He throws a cutter, a slider. The slider would look like it was kind of high 70s. And that, now I'm going by, you know, MLB's pitch identification. So we'll try to make sure we're calling these pitches correctly as we go forward. But his cutter was in the mid to high 80s, mm-hmm. and then he was throwing a 93, 94-mile-an-hour fastball. We know he has had command issues in the past, but it looked like he was able to throw all three pitches for strikes. I was at the game on Thursday, so my angle of watching kind of exactly where location was wasn't great. But I liked it. I think he is now kind of – I don't know that he supersedes Rhysop, but it's clear to me that right now Jason Grilley, as Clint Hurdle has said, actually verbalized it, that Jason Grilley's his eighth inning guy. And what I think you'll see Juan Cruz come in and be a guy who leads off innings. And I think Chris Rhysop will kind of revert to that role where he get out of jams. He's going to be the first guy to call out of that bullpen in the seventh or eighth inning when men are on base. You need a strikeout. He was very effective in that role for a long period of time last year. So we'll see if he gets more of that.
Yeah, regarding what the Pirates are going to do once their starting pitchers come off the DL, I think it's clear that one of the guys who's going to be sent down is going to be one of the bench guys, the hitters. The other one's probably going to be a reliever because as you've pointed out before, Kevin Correa gives them a certain amount of flexibility if they can move him into a sort of a swingman role. I don't think Jared Hughes did himself any favors yesterday with his performance, but you know it could be Meek that gets sent down in that situation.
Yeah, I think we talked about it. He does have an option, right?
Yeah, he does.
Well, you know, it's definitely a possibility. It's Evan Meek. You're right. It's one of those two. I don't think there's any question about that. Correa, while he might not be around in August, I don't think there's any point in risking losing him, and then you have an injury, and your depth at starting pitching mm-hmm. goes down dramatically. Even if Brad Lincoln is the next guy, the problem is the guy after that is, you know, who knows who.
Right.
So, I think that is the general plan and how I would expect to see things come out. The Burnett is going to go. He's going to throw 80 pitches, I think, on Wednesday, 2 days from now, down in Bradenton. I think they'll like to get him a start in Indianapolis before he comes up. And we're going to see Charlie get a start in Indianapolis here. Is that, I don't even know. Is that
it's
tomorrow?
Today. It's today, actually.
Today. So,
yeah.
So. And Garrett Cole goes tonight. So we've got some fun things to watch for. And, you know, I know you've been doing these minor league threads. So let's just is there something that jumped out of you here in these first couple of days in the minor leagues, aside from Stetson Alley not being able to throw a strike?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the strikeouts for Josh Bell is one thing to watch going forward. I mean, it, you know, all the usual caveats about small sample sizes are even you know, greater in this circumstance. You're talking about players we know in some cases very little about how they're going to do in the pros. But I think of the fact that Cole has he pitched in the Arizona Fall League, of course, but he has his first official pro start tonight in Bradenton. It's going to happen right around the time this podcast gets posted. I wonder, what are your expectations for him tonight?
That's a great question. What are my expectations? I think he'll be on a kind of, I'm going to guess he's going to be on a 60 pitch count type of thing, where he probably will see some of the Jameson Taillon stuff that we saw last year. He goes right, maybe for four innings. But I expect him to perform well. He was good in the Arizona Fall League. You know, let's guess four innings, six strikeouts, a walk, and a couple hits and a run. But I think the big thing will be command and to see how efficient he can be with his pitches and if he's overpowering guys. I'm interested to hear if he's hitting 97, 98 on the gun, or if they've told him to dial it down here early in the season. But, you know, that's one of the reasons both those guys are in Florida, is because you don't know what the weather's going to be like in other places. And, you know, they're going to get good weather, and it's going to be warm down there. You shouldn't have any trouble getting loose, all those things. I mean, they're, you know, maybe it's overly conservative, but I don't have any problem with it. And I'll be an interested, spectator, in the sense that I can be from here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to add today?
No, but let's why don't we try and get back at this here in the next 2 days, maybe after the first Dodger game, we can get something done, because I'd like to just kind of flip around the league a little bit. And some people suggested they'd like to hear some stuff of things going around the division. So maybe one of the three, maybe if we do three of these a week. By the way, we appreciate all the feedback on the last one in the comments section. You can email or tweet either of us. We'll make sure that information is easily accessible to you. And we'll take questions in the comments if there are things that you want to ask us about our opinions about things, or if there are topics you'd like us to discuss. We're feeling our way through this. We appreciate the support and the feedback. So things you'd like to do, we will do as well. But we'll try and get on Charlie and I'll talk about this, but try and get on a regular schedule. We're in season. There's probably enough content, if we're keeping this to 30 minutes, to do three of these a week, if our schedules are willing and we can match things up. And maybe one of those three, as we often do with the Steelers, when we look at the opponent, we'll look not only as Charlie did today with the Dodgers, but we'll look at what's going on in the division, and maybe more broadly what's going around the major leagues.
Coming up next is an interview with Eric Steven from TrueBlueLA.com regarding the Dodgers series that's coming up, so stick around. Back to the Bucks Dugout Podcast. I'm Charlie Wilmoth, here with Eric Steven from the Dodgers blog True Blue LA. Eric, how are you doing today?
Hey, Charlie. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Pirates obviously starting a series with the Dodgers on Tuesday. Not sure how much you may have heard about this, but the Pirates took 2-3 from the Phillies in their first series, faced two former Cy Young winners in Roy Halladay and Cliff Lee, and now we'll have to face another one in Clayton Kershaw on Tuesday. It may not be the Clayton Kershaw we're used to seeing, though. He pitched three innings in his first start and is still apparently suffering from the after effects of the flu. What do you expect from him in his next start against the Bucks?
Yeah, they don't. Dodgers really don't have a backup plan if he can't go, but they do expect him to start that game. I don't anticipate him to have any problems like he did on Thursday. He was sort of, you know, moving around a little better in the last few days in San Diego, so it looks like he'll be fully ready to go. I know he sort of gutted out three scoreless innings while feeling the effects of the stomach flu, and he cut short his pregame warm-ups before that game in San Diego, and mm-hmm. AJ Ellis was saying that it's something Kershaw never does. He's very methodical and has sort of a set routine, and he knew something was up when that happened. But it looks like he'll be ready to go. You know, I guess technically he could be still a little under the weather, but I think by tomorrow, especially with the off day today, he'll be fully rested.
Next up, the Pirates would face Chad Billingsley, who last started, I believe, on Friday against the Padres and was dominant, posting 11 strikeouts and just one walk over eight and a third innings. Is that something you did you see anything different in that first start for Billingsley than we usually see, or do you think he's the same guy he's always been?
Well, I mean, he's been working on some mechanical stuff in his delivery. He was sort of flying open a bit out of the windup from last season, and he really struggled in the second half. And he's had sort of flashes of brilliance off and on, sort of peaked in 08, and he had a really good 2010. You can't say we expect like 11 strikeouts and 8 innings every time, but he's definitely someone who could put it all together. He could be sort of the Dodgers like Ian Kennedy this year if he puts it all together and has a great year, and he could sort of vault not the top of the league, but somewhere near the top, maybe like a top 5, top 10 Cy Young type finisher if he puts it all together. So there was definitely encouraging, and the signs are all there that he's sort of back to fully healthy, mechanically sound, and very, very encouraging sign for the Dodgers.
Right. I mean, the issue with him seems to always be his control. Neither of us want to draw any crazy conclusions from a good start in San Diego, of all places. But he is the right age where you could potentially see a breakout this year.
Yeah, he was sort of working on some stuff during the spring. It was weird because the last few starts, I mean, the results weren't there. But every time, we would talk to him after the start, he was saying he was very pleased with, like, his mechanics. And he kept mentioning, like, the late life on his fastball. It was exploding into the zone. And I think that was part of it, working with his mechanics, just sort of staying in line and staying closed, and helped give his fastball a little late explosion. And it definitely showed on Friday night. And he's been sort of falling in love with the cutter the last few years. And I don't know, he's had some decent success with it, but I think he throws it a little too much. And pitching coach Rick Honeycutt wanted him to mix in the slider more. And on Friday, he just sort of had it all working. He was throwing the slider and the cutter, sort of going back and forth on both sides of the plate with both pitches. And he really put it all together, and the results showed.
So for the third game, Chris Capuano is currently listed as the starter, and I guess the reason I phrase it that way is because there's some ambiguity about Ted Lilly's status. Is Capuano, in fact, the starter, and if so, what do you expect from him in his first year as a Dodger?
Yeah, it's definitely Capuano on Thursday. He was going to be, I guess, start the year as the fifth starter, but they maneuvered it a little bit once Lilly had to go on the DL. He had a stiff neck that caused him to miss a few starts, and he's actually, I think recovered from that now, but they just needed to build his arm strength up, so they utilized their off day to sort of push Lilly back to the 14th, and it gives him an extra reliever for seven games, I guess, to start the season. I guess it is 8 games, yeah. So Capuano will definitely start Thursday. He was pitching actually a decent game on Saturday. He didn't give up a run until the fifth, and then he just sort of fell apart. I think he walked 3 in the fifth and walked 5 for the game, so he just sort of lost all his command all of a sudden there. I don't expect him to be a great starter this year, but I do expect him to go longer than that. And he has decent strikeout rate. He seems to be fully healthy. He's, an extra year removed from the Tommy John surgery that caused him to miss like all of 08 and 09. And I do expect good things from him this year, just hopefully a little better than he was on Saturday.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about Matt Kemp. And the reason is that the Pirates just signed Andrew McCutchen to a big extension. At the time, that extension was compared to those of Jay Bruce and Justin Upton. But if you want to look at a player that's who's a couple years older than McCutchen, who has maybe followed a sort of somewhat similar career path, you might say it's Kemp. They're not exactly they're not all that similar in some ways. You can certainly make the argument that Kemp has a better pedigree in terms of hitting for average, but in terms of players, outfielders with a broad base of offensive skills who are also athletic, can do a lot of things on the bases, they are, sort of broadly similar. The interesting thing about Kemp's career is that there is a season in 2010 where he kind of took a little bit of a step backwards, hit 249, and then broke out in a big way the next year. when that sort of off season, not that he was bad that season, but in that off season in 2010, what was your thinking about him? How confident were you that this was still going to be a superstar type player in Major League Baseball?
Yeah, I mean, I can't say, you know, we predicted, that he would, the year he had last year, because that was just off the charts. But, you know, 2009, he really had a solid year. He sort of put it all together. And I think, for the most part, I think I was fairly confident he could repeat 2009 at least. I don't know. He had some mechanical issues in 2010. And a lot of people like to point to that he was dating Rihanna and all that kind of stuff. But he had some run-ins with coaches, Larry Bowa and Bob Schaefer that year. But, I mean, I think he came to camp. He lost some weight last year. He was very lean. He did mature. I mean, I'm sure that was part of it. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard to sort of predict that. But the case of, like, you know, Kemp versus McCutchen is interesting because – you look at Matt Kemp, if you go back to, say, like, maybe probably where he was at the end of 08, maybe part of 09, was where McCutchen is now, roughly similar. And it's one of those things where you see sort of the savings of, say, locking your star players up early. I think I went back and looked recently. I don't have it in front of me, but I think over the 6 years of service time that McCutchen is signed for, and I believe he's about $51 million, mm-hmm. Kemp is going to earn about $64 million, and that's just part of his, you know, he signed an 8-year, $160 million extension, obviously after his big year. And you wonder, you know, maybe had the Dodgers signed him a little earlier, extended him, maybe they wouldn't be having to pay him $20 million a year, you know, during his free agent years. But, you know, in hindsight, you never know on those things, because it would have looked bad if they signed him to a long extension and then he had the, you know, 2010. So, but definitely I think he's someone we can, the franchise is sort of pinning their hopes on him going forward. So you don't want to put him to the standard of going nearly 40-40 every year, but he's definitely, in the upper echelon of the game.
Right. In terms of mistakes you could make, that's definitely less of a mistake for the Dodgers than it would be for the Pirates in the case of McCutchen. Speaking of which, the Dodgers have a new ownership situation now, with Magic Johnson's group buying the team. How does that change your expectations for the team going forward?
Well, I mean, you look at it. I don't know the ownership breakdown, but it's probably somewhere in the neighborhood. You know, there's about six guys who are partners in this group, and I think Magic probably has less than 5%.
Yeah, I would imagine.
But he's like the perfect guy to have as the face of your group, because he's going to be the guy at the that the public sees. And I mean, everyone in LA loves Magic Johnson. He's my favorite athlete of all time. So to be honest, it's kind of weird this crossover where, you know, I grew up watching him play, and, you know, he's my favorite athlete, and the Lakers won all those titles, and now he's bought, you know, my favorite team, or he's part of the group that buying my favorite team. It's just all these worlds colliding. It's very odd for me. But I think to have him as the face, he's sort of the perfect guy. And you just hope that the rest of the ownership group, they do make the right decision, because that's ultimately what's going to decide it. But in terms of smoothing things over from, like, a transition stage from Frank McCourt to the new group, Magic's sort of the perfect guy to sort of wash away any sort of bumps in the road.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the NL West this year, most people are probably predicting that it's going to be the Diamondbacks or the Giants that win the division, but the Dodgers still have, obviously, a ton of talented players. Where do you see them finishing, and what kind of one-loss record do you see them having?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think Arizona is the favorite in the division. The Giants definitely could be up there. I would say the Dodgers are, like, probably going to finish second or third. I see them as, like, a mid-80s win team, like, say, 82 to 86 or something like that wins. But you never know. They could get off to a hot start, and maybe they're a little better. Maybe they pick someone up at the deadline. I don't know. And the question is, will that be enough to contend? I don't think it will be. There's a chance Arizona comes back to the pack a little bit, so that's sort of what you almost pin your hopes on. In a perfect world, they could probably win, like, 88, 89 games with the current team they have. So it's not hopeless or anything, but I do think they're most likely going to finish second or third and just miss the playoffs.
Okay. Thanks, Eric, for answering our questions, and good luck this week.
Thanks, Charlie. I hope for a good series.
It's Eric Steven from TrueBlueLA.com, SB Nation's Dodgers blog. For David Todd, I'm Charlie Wilmoth, and thanks for listening to the Bucks Dugout Podcast. Leave us your comments.